This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Good to have you with us today. A bit later in the hour, pioneering cancer doctor Vincent DeVita Jr. will join us to talk about the politics of cancer research and the hurdles facing future treatments. But first, there are two little words which, whispered in the middle of the night, is sure to strike terror into the soundest of sleepers. Those words, bed bugs. Ooh. But scientists are not taking these bugs lying down. Two teams mapped out the genome of the hardy little bloodsucker to find out what makes it tick. Brooke Burrell is here to tell us about that story and other selected short subjects in science. She writes the Modern Plagues blog and is author of a book about bed bugs called Infested. Welcome back.
Thanks for having
You're
me.
You're the perfect person for this for this topic. Tell us about what did the researchers, what did they find when they went in there?
Yeah, so they found a lot of things, some new things, some things that we already knew, but altogether confirming what we already suspected, and that's that bed bugs are pretty gross and annoying. So some of the genes that they found different sets of genes, relatively small number of genes related to sight and smell, possibly because bed bugs don't really have to rely on these things to find us in our beds. It's not that hard to find us across our bedrooms. They also found some increased number of genes associated with this elastic protein called resilin. And this is interesting because bed bugs mate during this process called traumatic insemination, where the male actually stabs the female through her exoskeleton into her gut. And the resilin, perhaps in her exoskeleton, is making it sort of elastic to kind of protect her from that. And also, the researchers confirmed many different genes that are relevant for pesticide resistance, which is a problem that's been happening for a decade or so now. It's one of the main problems with controlling this pest. And so eventually, probably not in the near future, but scientists may be able to use this as a blueprint to find new ways to control them.
They didn't find that yet.
Right. Not the solution.
Yeah, the part we
all
want to hear, but
right.
Get rid of them or keep them away. They haven't found that yet. Let's talk next about the Zika virus. What's the latest on the Zika virus?
Yeah, well, the CDC issued some more travel alerts this week in parts of Central America, including Costa Rica, El Salvador, several other countries there, the Caribbean, and also the Pacific Islands. So if people are traveling to those, it's not a total travel ban to those areas, but people might want to look at the CDC website for advice on traveling there. There have been some more cases in the U.S. Scientific American actually put together this map of Zika cases since 2007. They noted more than two dozen since that year. But it's important to note that these are probably mostly travelers who have picked this up elsewhere. These aren't transmissions in the U.S. One exception to that is this case in Texas earlier this week where someone appears to have gotten Zika through sexual transmission. This isn't necessarily a new thing. It seems to be pretty rare, but that's how they got that. And then I did also see a report this morning that the lead Brazilian Health Research Institute said that they discovered active Zika in urine and saliva, so that it does seem to be able to survive in certain body fluids.
Almost like the rest of the iceberg is unveiling from the tip.
Some of it, anyway. There's a lot we still don't know.
Yeah, and Florida is very upset about this.
A lot of people are upset. I mean, a lot of people are upset, but probably because
there's
so many.
State of emergency, right?
Yeah,
in Florida.
So many unknowns here. I think that's part of the scary thing.
Mm-hmm. You wrote an article that fact-checked some of the science claims that presidential candidates have been making this cycle.
Yes, at Popular Science. So yeah, we were looking at different comments and claims that have been made during the debates on Twitter and media campaigns and sort of collecting those and fact-checking the science in those. So we saw some not too surprising patterns, comments about climate change, about vaccines, things like that. And then we gathered those together to talk about those and the actual science behind them.
Mm-hmm. And?
Well,
Drum roll, please.
Well, I mean, here's an example of a quote that we found. This is from Donald Trump in the September GOP debate. I'm not going to do a Donald Trump voice, so sorry for listeners out there. I'm just going to read it. But he said, autism has become an epidemic 25 years ago, 35 years ago. You look at the statistics, not even close. It has gotten totally out of hand, and I'm totally in favor of vaccines, but I want smaller doses over a longer period of time. So we took quotes like this, and of course here he's kind of hedging a little bit. He's saying he's trying to connect them with autism, but then at the same breath saying he's for vaccines, but he wants smaller doses. Of course, if you do a smaller dose of a vaccine, those doses are selected for a very specific reason. There's no point in doing a smaller dose. It's not going to protect you in the same way. And spreading them out, you know, the CDC and experts make these schedules based on a lot of different things. If you spread the vaccines out, you're just making kids more vulnerable to these infectious diseases. The other thing we found in doing this, this science is not necessarily partisan, but most of the comments that we found in this particular presidential primary, or these primaries, were from the Republicans. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, as recently as 2008, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were actually making statements questioning, for example, the science on vaccines and autism. They've changed their minds since then, but both parties have goofed up on stuff like this in the past.
But we see very little, very few, if no questions about science from the moderators.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The politicians seem to just bring this up when... in other situations. Not a lot of questions there, unfortunately.
You know, and even about climate change or global warming or any of these things, or your state's going to be underwater. What are you going to do about it?
I know. It has such an effect on policy, so it's kind of a shame.
Yeah, there was this organization called Science Debate 2008. You mentioned 2008. They tried to get something going, and now these many years later, they're still trying to get some questions into the debates, and maybe when they narrow down the field and want something substantive, excuse me for my cold, they'll get there. Let's talk about make sure I have this right. This is a story about a death by cow.
Getting that right?
Okay.
Yeah, this is actually, I saw this on the blog Inkfish at Discover by Elizabeth Preston. It's a great blog. She wrote about this study from the University of Liverpool. So these scientists had noticed cases where people were getting killed by cows or hurt by cows when they're out on walks in the countryside. So these scientists decided to dig into the literature. They went into scientific reports and also newspaper reports looking for cow or bovine, an attack or injury, and they found all these different cases. So unsurprisingly, it's more dangerous. Cows are more dangerous if you work with them regularly, so farmers and vets and folks like that are in more danger of cows. But they did find 54 cow attacks on people since 1993, 13 of which caused them people to die. So 13 cases where these cows killed these people.
Wow.
Yeah.
And no tipping involved.
Tipping involved. Just hiking.
It's just hiking. Well, that's fascinating. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Brooke Burrell writes the Modern Plagues blog and is author of a book about bed bugs. I think we're all going to get one of those copies now called Infested. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And here's an interesting story you may have not heard about. Let's say you have a data center, one of those rooms filled with the racks of computers that crunch numbers for businesses or help store your data in the cloud. What would happen if you dropped one in the ocean? I know you were thinking about that, right? Well, Microsoft gave it a try. Is this crazy or is it cunning? Contributing producer Charles Berquist is here with the soggy story. Welcome, Charles.
Yeah, right.
What's going on?
Well, this is a test by Microsoft. And as you said, they built a mini data center. This was a very small prototype, only one server rack. So imagine a rack about the size of a refrigerator or something filled with computers. They took one of those, put it inside a big steel tube, and sunk it in the ocean about 30 feet down, just off the coast of San Luis Obispo in California.
Mm-hmm. Because they could?
Well, yeah, because it was there. But they give three reasons that they tried this. The first one is, if anybody's ever been in a big computer room, you know that computers like to be kept cool. Mm. And so by putting the data center in the cool ocean water, they could get that cooling without having to pay the AC bill.
Or create all kinds of pipes and things and cooling systems and stuff like that.
Right. The big tube that they put the computers in basically had some radiator fins on the outside, and so it was just giving the heat off into the ocean water around the tube.
How big is it? Give us an idea of what it was.
It's about 10 feet long by 7 feet across. It's a big cylinder.
And it weighs, must be pretty
heavy. It's like 38,000 pounds or something.
Whoa.
Like that.
And so you have to run a power cable to it, right?
So this one, it was connected by a power cable to the shore. Mm-hmm. They're hoping that if they keep going with this concept in the future, they might be able to use some sort of renewable energy, maybe tidal power or wave power, to lessen the need for that shore connection. Of course, you would still need a data connection to get the information to and from the data center.
That seems like a good idea. If you want to save money on the on your cooling bill, you stick it in the ocean, let the ocean do the cooling. What could be the bad thing about this?
Well, one of their engineers likened it sort of to launching a satellite. If you're putting this thing down in the ocean, you're not going to want to mess with it. So they're planning this whole thing to be running without anybody touching it for maybe 5 years at a time. So that takes some engineering in terms of planning for redundancy and what happens when something fails and what happens if I need to reboot it, things like that. But in terms of the advantages, they're thinking, in addition to the cooling, if they do this, they can basically mass produce these things. Instead of needing to build a data center and find a building and hire the HVAC guys and the plumbers and hire people, they can just this one they were able to construct and drop in 90 days.
Is it still down there? Or
this one was
a test, just a test.
This was just a test. It was down there for about 3 months. Then they pulled it out, and they're considering doing a larger scale one a little bit down the road.
Of course, you don't have to drop it in the ocean. You have a big lake nearby. You could do it there, right?
Right. They point out that so much of the Earth's population is near some large body of water, either the coast or a lake. So this might be an option for the Great Lakes as well.
But it's going to heat up the water a little, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely environmental concerns, especially if they build bigger ones of these and drop lots more of them. But they say that they were able to measure just very little cooling, very little heating, just a couple inches away from the tube itself. So they're thinking that the heating is probably not a major concern.
All right. Fascinating new idea. Thank you, Charles.
You're welcome, Ira.
Contributing at producer Charles Berquist. When we come back, how the war on cancer is winnable from someone who is on the front lines, Dr. Vincent DeVita, Jr., who is past head of the National Cancer Institute and a cancer survivor himself. Great new book called The Death of Cancer. We'll talk about it right after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In his State of the Union address, President Obama called for a moonshot to cure cancer in the war that has cost over $100 billion since 1971, when we officially declared war on cancer. And despite the drumbeat in the media that we are losing the war on cancer, my next guest says that he can lay out a blueprint for winning the war in his new book, The Death of Cancer. A cancer survivor himself, Dr. Vincent DeVita Jr. and co-author Elizabeth DeVita Rayburn talk about the history of cancer research and new treatments that are not only hopeful, but are turning cancer into a chronic treatable disease. Dr. DeVita is author of The Death of Cancer and professor of medicine at the Yale Center Cancer Center in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's been many years since we've chatted.
Yes.
Let's go right to the president's moonshot. Do you think he was correct in calling for that now?
Well, I think the field is really starving for resources, so any infusion of money would be very well appreciated and I think well used. I think the worrisome thing is not to make the mistake that was made in 1971 with the passage of the first Cancer Act and try to put a date certain on it because biology is way too uncertain for that.
Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. I was quoting from your book at the beginning there, where you write, if you believe the drumbeat in the media, we have spent more than $100 billion on cancer research, and we're losing the war on cancer. And you think that totally misses the point of what's really happening.
Yeah, I mean, the mandate of the Cancer Act was to support research and the application of the results of research to reduce the incidence, morbidity, and mortality from cancer. It didn't say in 10 years or in 20 years. And the support for research, two-thirds of that $100 billion went to support research. The application side is what suffered. It's very difficult to have the flexibility that you need to apply the results of research these days. But the incidence of cancer has come down since 1991 for some cancers, and the mortality rate has come down overall 25%, and for some major cancers even more. And the morbidity is much less. I mean, if you look at cancers like breast cancer, how it's treated now, compared to how it was treated in the 1970s. It's a completely different animal. So I think it's fulfilled its mandate. It took a long time, and the payoff in the biology is enormous. We know things now we never would have dreamed about.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to those early days a little bit. I know you were highly involved in it, as you can see in the book. You write, there was a time when chemotherapy was a dirty word. There were shouting matches, and insults would break out at cancer meetings over these new treatments.
Yeah, it was not an easy time. I had it just a touch easier than the people who came before me, but I do remember, you know, meetings where people would get up in the audience and shout insults that I would have thought were unimaginable at a university, but they did it. There was very strong feelings about it. Just somehow, if you mentioned that you could cure cancer with drugs, it was considered slightly the other side of sanity.
Mm-hmm. We've heard that, you know, over the years, as journalists and people who cover medicine a lot, we've heard so many times there's no such thing as cancer because there are 100 different types of cancer. But you say that now you can narrow down multiple hallmarks, as you call them, that are shared by all cancers that require complex clinical trials of a new kind. Tell us about what you mean by narrowing down to those multiple hallmarks and why that offers us new opportunities we didn't have before.
Well, there was a landmark paper published 10 years ago and then a repeat just recently by Hanahan and Weinberg called The Hallmarks of Cancer. And what they point out is there are certain characteristics, acquired characteristics, that a cancer cell has to have to become malignant, to grow, then to make its own blood supply, to evade the immune system, and to metastasize. And all cancers need to require more or less the 8 hallmarks. Some depend more on one than another. So instead of focusing on 100 different cancers, you can attack the hallmarks. In fact, the cancer therapies that work have been, although they weren't designed that way, have been inadvertently attacking the hallmarks. Most of them attack the hallmark of uncontrolled growth, for example. But, you know, recently we've now begun to unravel the immune system problem that we had faced before. That's another hallmark, immune surveillance of cancer. So I think we could narrow our focus, but these require very complicated clinical trials. You're going to be looking at one drug to attack one hallmark, another drug to attack another hallmark, and that requires a certain degree of flexibility that we don't have at the moment.
Talk about that a little bit more. You say that it's impossible under current government regulations to carry out what you're saying are truly needed kinds of research.
It takes too long. And my own view is we need the FDA. I'm not really proposing that we do away with the FDA. But the FDA, I think, is approving drugs based on the last century criteria. We really basically should approve cancer drugs based on their safety in the context of a cancer patient who's dying of cancer and the ability to hit a known biological target and then let the investigators at cancer centers play with the drugs that we have in the post-marketing period so that we can come up with novel ways of attacking all 8 hallmarks in cancer. And this sort of like I describe in the early days what a colleague of mine named the Society of Jabbering Idiots, which was like a war room for what we had in those days, which was a very exciting meeting. It was one of the most exciting meetings I've ever attended in my life, where you could take the data that came in on a day-by-day basis and make adjustments in your treatment protocols. We can't do that now, but there is plenty of data. There are plenty of data that could be used that way. For example, if you know the biologic pathways that are abnormal in a cancer cell of a particular type, one can really mix and match with the drugs available to attack those pathways. There are attempts to do that, but they're really thwarted by the fact that it takes months to get protocols approved. And if you want to adjust a protocol, you have to go back to the end of the line and start all over again.
Let me hone in on a couple of cases here that you write about that sort of illustrate this. You talk about 2 drugs approved by the FDA for melanoma that have not yet been approved for lung cancer, but you write that thousands of patients with lung cancer are being deprived of years of good life right now for no earthly reason.
Well,
that sounds pretty strong.
It is pretty strong, but these drugs have now been approved for lung cancer. But I'll give you an example. My own sister died of lung cancer in May. She was in a hospital where these drugs were being used, and every cancer doctor I knew of who took care of lung cancer knew then and now feel that these are the best drugs that have come along in 40 years for lung cancer. They had been approved in melanoma, so we knew their safety profile was okay, and the data were really there in the early trials that it was working in lung cancer, but you couldn't get them. And the doctors taking care of her could have gone the route of a compassionate IND, but that takes unbelievable amount of time that no functioning physician can actually do. So my sister died without having a chance to get a crack at a drug that had maybe give her a 60% chance of having a decent prolongation of life. And that happens all the time. So I think we're there. We need to change how we let patients access experimental drugs. We had a system, I describe it in the book, what we call the Group C system in the 1970s, that actually worked. When I left the Cancer Institute, the FDA scotched it. I think that's one of the problems we're facing today. That falls under the category of the mandate that said the application of the results of research. That was the tricky part of the war on cancer. When the Cancer Act was passed, the NIH really had no interest in the application of the results of research. So the cancer war broke the ground on the application side.
So what were they doing the research for if they weren't going to apply it?
Well, it's a very interesting mindset. In those days, people worked to find new knowledge, and they just assumed that if it was important enough, it somehow would find its way into the clinic. Nowadays, it's quite different. Scientists, when they make a discovery, they immediately think of the application of that discovery. But in those days, it was just support research. We didn't, frankly, have a lot of new information at that time.
Is that because drug companies are so much more working in unison with the universities now, and they can see that there's a potential moneymaker here?
Yeah, I think the fact that years ago the Congress said we could patent biologics made a big difference, that people see the opportunity to have an important drug. But I think still, because there have been successes in drugs that have attacked important targets, mm-hmm. that people have the incentive to do that.
You call yourself an aggressive doctor. And in the book, you write that regulations and research protocols stood in the way of potential treatments for your friend Lee, who was suffering prostate cancer. But later in the book, you also write, medicine is by definition a conservative field. It should be, in a way, people's lives depend on it. So when do you become an aggressive doctor, and when do you become a conservative doctor?
I think that if there's a chance that somebody will respond to something, then that's you become an aggressive doctor. You shouldn't really cut off any avenue of hope for a cancer patient. This is misinterpreted to think that I would never let someone die, no matter what stage they're in, and that's not true. There are people we really can't help. But there are lots of cancers where there's something you can do, especially today. All these new advances, when they come out, they don't come out universally across the country. They come out in pockets. They may come out in New York and Cancer Center there. They may come out at Yale. They may come out in California. And so not everybody's always aware of them, and it makes it a little bit difficult to get at them. But many times, and I think the new immunotherapy drugs, for example, are a good they're not universally available. They weren't universally available just a few months ago, but they are probably the best thing that's come along for many cancers.
That's one of the drugs that President Clinton was on immunotherapy.
Yeah, Carter.
Carter,
yeah.
Thank you. He was on immunotherapy, and he says he was cancer-free of it. Tell us how promising you cite work of Steven Rosenberg, who... He says we have finally arrived at the point where immunotherapy has reached its full potential. That sounds very promising.
Yeah, well, Steve has been a pioneer in developing immunotherapy now, going back when it wasn't very popular. But the big advance that happened was when Jim Allison at MD Anderson Hospital uncovered what we call the checkpoints in lymphocytes. We were always puzzled for many years why immunotherapy would occasionally work brilliantly, but mm-hmm. in most cases it didn't. And it turned out the lymphocytes have checkpoints that prevent them from attacking ourselves so that we don't have more what we call autoimmune diseases. What he did was found the checkpoint, developed antibodies to block them, and sort of like the lymphocyte woke up and said, whoa, I can see this cancer, and they can attack it. And the checkpoint inhibitors, I think, are extremely exciting. And I, you know, for almost all cancers where they're being tested, and they're being tested in virtually every cancer, there's some degree of response, in some cases more than others, but I think they are the example of how we're finally unlocking the potential of the immune system.
You know, we're reading more and more about the microbiome and how essential it is for so many things that are going on in the body. Do you think it could also be involved in cancer suppression?
Well, we know that, you know, for example, we know that stomach cancer is related to a bacteria called Helicobacter, and lymphomas of the stomach related to the same bacteria. And then we know when they're very early in lymphomas of the stomach and you treat the bacteria, the lymphoma goes away. So yeah, we know the microbiome has a role, and I think we're just learning a lot about how it may play a role in cancer. My own feeling is that, you know, we've always been puzzled by these interesting conundrums in terms of diet and cancer. We know diet's important because of migration studies. When people migrate to it from an area of low cancer incidence of a certain type, say breast cancer, and they migrate to the U.S. and incidence goes up, we've never been able to use that information. And I guess the microbiome is going to provide some data on that. It's probably alterations in the microbiome that may be influencing the cancer cell. The other thing that's happened at about the same time is we've learned that the tumor microenvironment, where, you know, a cell is sitting in the liver, the environment around it is very important because the normal cells can actually talk to cancer cells. And I think the same thing happens in the microbiome. They can receive signals from bacteria, even though the bacteria are just normal bacteria. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot to learn there, but I think it's going to be an exciting phase.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Dr. Vincent DeVita, Jr., who was a new book. And this is a great read, a highly readable book on cancer. Who of us doesn't know somebody with cancer, a survivor or a friend? It's called The Death of Cancer. I highly suggest it. Before we I have so many things I want to get to. Before we get to the break, I want to ask you about this idea that of making cancer a chronic disease, something you might be able to treat. And as new medicines come out, you then extend the life of someone further and further.
Well, I think the best example of that is the first example of real targeted therapy. That's where we have a target in the cell, the cancer cell, and we attack that particular target. There's a disease called chronic myelocytic leukemia. When I was starting out, this was a universally fatal disease. They called it chronic because the average survival was about 42 months. In 1996, Dr. Brian Druka from Oregon reported the results of an attack on the one molecular abnormality in this disease. We call it BCR-ABL. It's a gene. And that disease now is a chronic disease. People live virtually a normal lifespan by taking a pill every day. Now, sometimes they develop resistance to that pill, and the pharmaceutical industry has developed four more that have already been approved. They're available so they can substitute one pill for another. You can look and you can find the disease in most cases. There are a few cases where it appears to be totally gone. But in most cases, it's still there, but it doesn't bother the patient because the white cells that are affected function normally. So here you have what was a universally fatal disease, which is now a chronic disease. I think maybe as we work and learn how to combine different agents, we'll eradicate the cells entirely. But until then, these patients are living a really very normal life. And I think we're seeing more of that, even with the new immunotherapy drugs, where the immune system seems to put the tumor in abeyance, and the patients seem to be normal, even though if we look hard, we can still find the tumor. So that's a new way of thinking about cancer. You know, you cure whatever you can cure. You convert whatever you can convert to a chronic disease with a normal lifespan. But if you don't do either one, then patients usually die of it. So that's why I always say cancer is the most curable chronic disease, but it's also the most fatal chronic disease.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Dr. Vincent DeVita, Jr., author of The Death of Cancer. Our number, if you'd like to call in, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Dr. Vincent DeVita Jr., who is the author of The Death of Cancer. He is a former head of the National Cancer Institute, worked his whole life in the field of cancer, and a cancer survivor from prostate cancer, which you talk a lot about in your book. And as you know, you make the case that you're a doctor and you hardly knew, you know, the panic was not foreign to you. But one of the points you make in your book is that you advise people that finding a good cancer doctor is essential, and to be around that, be around, quote unquote, is how you put it. And if you can't find a good advocate, to keep an eye out there where the action is, one willing to ignore traditional boundaries in medicine. You who know everybody in the field, how do you find a good cancer doctor and a good place to go?
It's not easy, but I can't find a good lawyer either. So you need to ask around, ask people, use whatever information you can. If you have a great primary care doctor, as I do, that person can usually find somebody for you. But I think, you know, you want a doctor who believes in what he's doing. I think one of the problems we had early days and still sometimes now is that cancer doctors who don't really believe that the therapy they're giving works that well or is worth the effort. So I say in the book, if somebody tells you, if you're newly diagnosed with cancer and they say, there's nothing I can do for you, then you should find another doctor.
And what do you mean by one willing to ignore traditional boundaries in medicine?
Well, I touched on it before. I think that if there are drugs out there that we think work, you know, when you hear about these, you go to meetings and you hear about them, and your patient might be a candidate for that drug, then can you use it off-label, for example, which is frowned on by the FDA, is frowned on by hospital pharmacies. I have a doctor I mention in the book, just one doctor, who seems to be able to do this for everybody. He not only gets access to new treatments, he sometimes gets the insurance companies to pay for them. So it can be done, but it takes a lot of effort. And these kinds of doctors are, when you find them, you should hang on to them.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Lake Tahoe to Susan. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thank you. I have had three cancers. One in 2001, I had LCIS and DCIS. In 2012, I was diagnosed with stage 3, 3B colon cancer, and went through the FOLFOX treatment protocol. And then in 2014, I was diagnosed with lung cancer and had a thoracotomy. I'm 58 now, and I'm wondering if what kind of research is being done with regard to individuals who have multiple cancers, and if you have any advice for someone like me who is right now going through CT scans every 6 months, chest and abdomen, but anything beyond that that I could do proactively.
Well, you certainly haven't been lucky in terms of getting cancers, but you seem to be well. I mean, you've managed to survive three difficult cancers. There are lots of genetic analysis going, and I think if you haven't seen a genetic counselor, you probably should, to see if there is some common trait that might be passed on to other members of the family.
And they haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think what you're doing is I can't argue with it. Success.
All right, Susan. Good luck to you. Is personalized medicine now moving heavily in cancer therapy?
Oh yeah, I think now with the ability to sequence the genome, we can sequence cancers for the mutations that we know are important, and we have drugs that target those mutations. Mm-hmm. Certainly in lung cancer now, you can treat people who have specific mutations with drugs that work only against that particular type. Unfortunately, they're in the minority in lung cancer, so they hardly ever make up more than 20% of the population.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to the title of your book, The Death of Cancer and the War on Cancer is Winnable and How We Can Get There, yet cancer is still the second leading cause of death, killing nearly 600,000 Americans in 2014, just behind heart disease. That must still indicate we have a long way to go, or why is that number still so high?
Well, you know, a lot of the new things I'm talking about have just not reached the widespread use yet. So I think you're still some very difficult cancers. But I'm encouraged by the fact that a tumor like melanoma, the malignant mole, which was really, you either removed it and cured a patient or they died from it. We had very little therapy that worked, is now teetering on one of the, on the edge of being one of the curable tumors when they have metastatic disease. This was unheard of, a few years ago. The new the targeted therapies called BRAF inhibitors, and the immunotherapies are working very well in these patients. Mm-hmm. We have patients living for years now. And then lung cancer, which was really a very difficult tumor to treat with chemotherapy, with not a great deal, some benefit, but not a great deal of benefit, is now responding to the immunotherapy drugs. So we're starting to see the common cancers, succumb to the new treatments.
I read a research paper on mice recently that a probiotic, when given with these drugs you're talking about, actually dramatically increased the survival rate. Why would that be? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've seen it, yeah. I mean, I've seen
reference
to it.
What's your opinion on it? Too early to think about that?
No, but I think the as I said before, there's no question that bacteria are able to send signals, so we're obviously altering the gut bacteria is doing something in those mice. So I would hasten to point out that mice are not humans, and they often mislead us. But it just signifies that the microbiome is important. And we're likely to find ways to make it useful in cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm. How do you
I was going to add that there's a combination of Chinese herbs that have been used for about 2,000 years that when you give them along with chemotherapy also alters the toxicity markedly. My guess is probably mostly through altering the microbiome. So there's a lot of people looking at this now, and hopefully we'll get some usable information.
So your book is very, very hopeful. I mean, and it lays out where that hope lies and giving us case histories of it, whereas instead of just saying we can cure cancer.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm an undeniable optimist. But as I said before, the mandate of the Cancer Act has really been fulfilled. We've reduced the incidence of cancer. We've really markedly reduced the morbidity and mortality rates, the 25% overall decline in mortality, 25% for breast cancer. All these things are very real, and they're old data. They're data that are about 5 years old. When they finally catch up to 2016, they'll be even more impressive.
One last question. Does it help to just throw more money at it, which is what we do?
No. That would be my only warning. I think that if you're going to put more money into the system, you should revise the system so that you can have more flexibility to use all the new information. In the book, I mentioned the fact that we really need, and it's an unfortunate term, but a cancer czar in the government, because a lot of money is in the Defense Department for cancer research, the NIH, the CDC, the FDA. You need someone to coordinate this effort and then coordinate it with the private sector. Plus, I think we need to alter, as I said before, about how we do clinical trials. We should delegate the responsibility for the early stage clinical trials to the cancer centers and let them do it. The FDA and the NCI can audit them whenever they want to. But it would save an untold number of days and would also save money. So I think, yes, more money, but give it with more flexibility.
The book is The Death of Cancer, written by Dr. Vincent DeVita Jr. and Elizabeth DeVita Rayburn, your daughter. And good luck to you, and thank you. It's a terrific book, and it's a primer for anybody who wants to know anything more about cancer. Thank you, and good luck with the book.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We have an excerpt of the book up at sciencefriday.com/deathofcancer. What would an election season be without the polls?
The latest Quinnipiac poll is showing Ben Carson surging past frontrunner Donald Trump in Iowa.
There's also new polling from the Des Moines Register. Donald Trump has 5 points ahead of Ted Cruz in that polling.
Last month, about a group organizing Iowa's first online straw poll, and now the results are in. Donald Trump is leading GOP candidates with 34% of the vote. Rand Paul comes in close second in this straw poll with 18%.
Yep, those polls all missed their mark. And for every voter type, state, caucus, and candidate, it seems like there's a poll for that. And with the proliferation of polls, online surveys, and big data, you'd think that someone would be able to get it right. Why is it so hard? Well, my next guest says that election polling is in near crisis. Cliff Zukin is professor of public policy and political science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, also founding director of the Center for Public Interest Polling. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Very nice to be with you.
Why do you say that polling is in a crisis? How bad is it out there?
Well, now, I want to make a distinction first. I'm not saying that polling is in crisis. I'm saying that election polling is in a crisis. I think, in fact, most public opinion polling is still quite good. But election polling is becoming more difficult to do, as is all polling. And it's a combination of two or three things. First is this tremendous growth of cell phones that we didn't have to worry about in 2008 and 2012. Maybe 10 years ago, the country was 6% cell phone only. Now it's 43%, and the country's 60% cell phone only or mostly. Mm-hmm. And cell phones are harder for us to do. They're much more expensive for us to do, given federal regulation.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your work that the response rate has just dropped like a rock since like 1970s.
Yeah, when I first started doing polling, we would get an 80 or 85% response rate. We would worry about the 15% we didn't get. When you looked at all the surveys done by the Pew Research Center over the last year or so, the average was 9% response rate.
From 80 to 9?
Yeah. And so
is there any reason why you're not getting an accurate result with just 9% response rate?
You know, it's really something that no one understands. When we compare results of general public surveys on smoking and health behaviors that we do in our normal surveys with the gold standard surveys of the American Community Survey and the Health and the Census, where participation is 100% because it's mandated, surprisingly, the surveys are still pretty accurate. But I have no idea why that works. If you had told me that we'd be just as accurate with a 10% response rate as an 80% response rate, I'd say you're crazy. But what it has done is to drive up the cost of polling to making many, many more calls, and cell phones are more expensive calls. And that's really what's changed the economics of the profession in the last 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about Cliff Zukin, about political polling. So how do you make it better? I mean, or you just can't make it better or more reliable.
Well, I don't think we're going to be ready in time for 2016. I think the Internet is the future. And telephone polling is going to be so expensive to do compared to the cheapness of Internet polling that I think that's where we're going to go. But we have problems with Internet sampling right now. First, not everybody has Internet, and it's older people who don't have Internet coverage, and those people are the most likely to vote. And then second, we don't have a good way to sample. Since this is Science Friday, it's nice to be with a group that you can say there's a scientific basis for public opinion polling and sampling based in inferential statistics, and that's what we use. We use probability samples. There's no good way right now to do an Internet-based probability sample where people opt in. We just don't have that developed yet for 2016.
Mm-hmm. And we're not anywhere close to it yet.
No, I think we will by 2020. I know there's an awful lot of experimentation going on. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, this is not evil intention or anybody trying to pull any of the wool over. You know, there are a lot of people in the industry working very hard to figure out how to do a non-probability sample that's accurate. It's just we're not ready for this election, I don't think.
Could it be that the questions on the poll just aren't the questions that people are thinking about, so they don't answer them?
No, I don't think so. You know, these are questions that have worked pretty well. You know, so we were very, very accurate in 2008 and pretty accurate in 2012, and I don't think the electorate's changed that much. I think in Iowa, a number of things happened. You know, there was some movement before, but polls are very... The third thing that's very different about election polling is that it's incredibly difficult to figure out who's actually going to vote from those people who tell you they're going to vote. And in Iowa, we had about a 20% turnout. And when you look at exit polls, it seems that the evangelical turnout was very strong, and that benefited Ted Cruz and Rubio, and Trump supporters were less likely to go to the caucus and more likely first-time caucus goers that didn't know the rules. And then polls are just horrible at measuring the ground game of get out the vote and organizational effort, because we don't really talk to that when we do random samples of the electorate. And no, also Iowa is an entrance poll. It's not an exit poll, so it gets people when they go in. But finding likely voters is the biggest problem of election polling.
A word that gets thrown out a lot by pollsters and analysis is outperforming or underperforming if the results don't match the poll. Isn't that sort of blaming the people for the inaccuracy of your poll?
Yeah, it's an unhealthy dynamic in a presidential nomination race, in that what you have is the end results, where one person got 24 and the other 21 or whatever, being judged not by X percent of delegates selected to the nomination convention, but by the expectations of the polls. And so now you see, because Cruz did better than expectations that were set by polls, he's able to command more attention in New Hampshire and set his own agenda. And so in some ways, the expectations set by election polls is an unhealthy dynamic in the way Americans choose a president. No question about that.
Yeah, well, there's something more to think about. We're going to check back in with you every now and then, okay, Cliff?
Yeah, happy to talk with you.
Cliff Zukin, professor of public policy and political science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. That's about all the time we have for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim, our associate producer. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. And Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And this week on the web, for all you teachers out there, if you're looking to inject a little fracking science into your curriculum, check out a collection of classroom games, models, and lessons at sciencefriday.com/frackingscience. Thank you all for putting up with my cold as I hack through the hour this week. I hope you're doing a lot better than I am. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.